meeting.
So the university is being run as a sort of adhocracy at this point. The senior administration making up policies and procedures and prohibitions on the fly, changing them in the middle of the night. One of those prohibitions was that no protests could take place on the steps of Lowe Library. I assume you will be showing images later about protests in 1968 of the Lowe Library. The faculty, in response, a broad coalition of faculty in response to the student arrests and to the bringing of police onto campus, chose yesterday to walk out at 2 p.m. in full regalia for many of us, to stand on the steps of Lowe Library in front of the statue of Alma Mater, a heralded tradition of protest on campus, to defend the rights of students, to denounce the police actions and the president's sanctioning of the police actions, to call for the immediate repeal of the suspension of our students, their restoration of all of their rights, the expungement of their records, and to submit an appeal for vote of censure in the University Senate of Manoush Shafiq and the senior administration,
And Professor Slaughter, not Columbia, but at universities across the country, we are repeatedly hearing that these protests in support of Palestinians who are being attacked in Gaza, that this is making life unsafe. These protests are making life unsafe for Jewish students on these campuses. What's your response to that?
So I have multiple responses. The messaging out of Columbia has consistently emphasized the dangers of these protests, in particular to Jewish and Israeli and pro-Israeli students. In fact, the messaging has been one of fear towards the explicitly. The messaging at the same time has been one of fear to students, to pro-Palestinian students, to anti-Zionist Jewish students, to other students who want to think about and talk about and discuss the questions of Palestine, the questions of Israel, which is the duty of a university to think about these hard problems. The message to those students is also fear, but a fear by omission. The university not ever acknowledging any of the fears, the Islamophobic actions that are taking on campus, any of the attacks that have taken place on campus. And so in some ways, the university itself, it seems to me, in its public messaging since October, has ginned up fear both among Jewish students and pro-Palestinian students. The campus, in fact, impromptu and improvised policies that has unilaterally imposed without consultation from the University Senate, without the traditions of shared governance, have in fact, in my opinion, chilled speech, not just of pro-Palestinian but also of pro-Israeli, protesters, and has absolutely chilled speech in classrooms and in other kind of forums on campus. Be able to even talk about the problems that lie at the bottom of all of this. That is, Palestinian rights to self-determination, Israeli rights to security.
And Professor Tawil Suri, what do you see happening in the coming days at NYU?
Oh, it's hard to say, but maybe quickly, if I could just add one thing. I mean, a lot of the students and the faculty at NYU who were part of the encampment and in general are part of sort of like SJP and FJP and so on are actually Jewish, right? So that's number one. The other thing that I think is, I don't know how much news has sort of come out since yesterday about what happened, but when the NYPD finally came in and sort of broke the encampment apart, it was in the middle of Muslim Maghrib prayers, like the evening prayers, right? So I think that kind of speaks a little bit to what you're saying, right, in terms of like the way that it's not really about sort of one group or the other, but also how different groups are kind of treated. In terms of what happens at NYU from this point on, I mean, I can tell tell you, the students feel very sort of spirited in the sense of like they want to kind of continue. You know, for them, it's about, okay, fine, you took us down, but we're going to continue. We have the right to protest. We have the right to academic speech. We have the right to free speech, and we have the right to kind of stand up for our pro-Palestinian voices, basically. I'm not quite sure. I mean, I can't sort of say how the university is going to respond, but you know, I think the students are going to sort of have to figure out like how are they going to be able to protest. So unlike Columbia, you know, NYU is this kind of you know somewhat urban kind of campus, right? So there is no lawn, if you want, to kind of go and protest on. And so I think that's part of what we saw yesterday is this plaza where the encampment took place is private property, but you know the moment you step off of the steps, it becomes a New York City property, right? Very sort of blurry line as to where does the NYPD kind of stop its sort of jurisdiction, if you want to call it that, versus where does campus security stop? So I think that's a little bit different, and I think that's a sort of challenge, if you want, that is faced by the students. But I think the students kind of are very resolved in the sense of like we're going to keep going with this.
Professor Tuwesuri, the New York Times subheadline was "Dozens arrested on Monday at NYU and Yale," but officials there and at campuses across the U.S. are running out of options to corral us, they said. What are the options that officials have at these universities besides arrests and suspensions?
That's a great question. I mean, maybe first to kind of have a discussion, right? Like kind of, you know, be sort of very open about like, all right, well, let's sort of sit down and talk about these things. Let's host a number of different events. Let's host a number of different speakers. Let's allow for these kind of speakers and events to happen. I think what we see is also a sort of shutdown of certain kinds of things, right? Let's allow for whether it's classes or teach-ins or all of that. And in terms of the protesters, I mean, it's a sort of, you know, I think part happened certainly at NYU is that there was a kind of compression, if you will. Right, so people in support were coming to demonstrate and the students and so on, but couldn't kind of access, right? So they bleed into the streets and the students can't get out, and so sort of a bit of a sort of pressure cooker in the sense that you of course creating this kind of barricade that becomes very difficult to manage, but it's also becoming a way that you know the barrier itself is actually creating part of the problem, right? So I think if you kind of have a way to kind of figure out how to sort of allow people to move around, to not necessarily prevent them from moving, I think a lot of problems would kind of not exist to begin with.
Same question, Professor Slaughter.
Thank you. One of the things that President Shafiq said in response to a question at Congress last week that I found most disturbing that hasn't been commented on at all is that what she's learned over this last 6 months is that our rules weren't made for this moment. And this justifies in some ways the administration throwing out the rule book and coming up with impromptu policies on how to police speech. Rules were made exactly for this moment. They were made for 1968. They were made from 1968 and to prevent a repeat of 1968. We have an extremely robust rules for the protections of speech and protest on campus. We have an extremely robust system for protecting due process rights for students when they have violated or are accused of having violated those protections. If this administration had chosen to lean into the statutes of the university and the rules about the rules that have kept our community together for 50 years, we would be in a month with faculty and students.
Well, I'm glad you went back in history because that's where we're going right now. Professor Slaughter of Columbia University and Professor Helga Tuwesuri of New York University. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. 56 years ago today, hundreds of students at Columbia University here in New York started a revolt on campus. They had buildings, including the president's office and the library. The students barricaded themselves inside the buildings for a week. They were protesting Columbia's ties to military research and plans to build a university in a public park in Harlem. The protests began less than 3 weeks after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. The 1968 Columbia uprising led to one of the largest arrests in New York City history. A week into the strike, April 30th, New York City police stormed the campus of Columbia University. Hundreds of students were injured, 700 arrested. Images of police assault were broadcast around the country. This is a clip from Columbia Revolt by Third World Newsreel.
They got over 700 of us on charges of criminal trespass, resisting arrest, all kinds of other, some of which was real and some of which was completely fake.
I know of nurses and doctors that pleaded with the police not to proceed to police, and they would say, no, no, that's gay, this is our job.
I was arrested. They would not allow me to see a doctor. I had broken ribs. My face was cut. I got hit with a pistol under the eye, and I was bleeding there, and I wasn't allowed to see a doctor until I got out of court, which was approximately 10 hours later.
But I was awarded a fellowship for next year. What the hell does... I'm sorry. What does it mean? I'm going to strike. But I hope every fact... I don't see how any teacher, I don't see how any student can attend this school anymore. And I was completely liberal about the whole thing. But this bus has riled everybody, and me very... personally.
No, I was a non-violent student. I was completely passive. I didn't care what happened. I was completely neutral. I'm not neutral anymore. 5 buildings tomorrow.
The 1968 Columbia uprising inspired student protests across the country. This is Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez, then a Columbia student, speaking during the strike.
Now we want to go into the dorms with all of you, with some of you who may not agree with a lot of what we've been saying here, who have questions, who support us, who want to know more. Let's go to the dorms. Let's talk quietly in small groups. We'll be there, and everyone in Livingston Lobby, Inferno Lobby, and Carmen Lobby. We'll be there, and we'll talk about the issues involved, and we'll talk about where this country is going and where this university is going and what it's doing in this society and what we would like it to do and what we would and how we would like to exchange with you our ideas over. Come join us now.
That was Juan Gonzalez, courtesy of the Pacifica Radio Archives. And Juan is here now, courtesy of Democracy Now!, co-host of Democracy Now! Juan, talk about that moment. We're talking about 56 years ago. Talk about then and what you see as the echoes of today.
Well, I mean, I think the important thing to understand is that the Columbia strike unfolded over several weeks. The first week was the week of the occupation, but because of the brutality of the attacks by the police, as you said, more than 150 people were hospitalized the night of April 30th. It led to a massive strike of the entire university. Over 10,000 students shut the university down for the rest of the semester. And I think what is really unusual about this process is that here the university moved in very quickly, and also these students were not disrupting classes. We occupied buildings. We did not allow classes to go forward in 1968, but classes were going forward. The students were camped out peacefully on the lawn. So the disproportionate nature of the response of the university, the quickness with which it responded without even consulting or listening to the faculty is really astounding. And the other aspect of it is that when we were suspended, and there were many of us suspended, before we were suspended, we were allowed to appear before a tribunal to plead our cause. There was at least the rudiments of due process. Here, there is no due process. The university is already within 24 hours saying that the students are suspended, even though there is yet no legal proof that any of these students knowingly participated in illegal actions. So I think that what really strikes me about this response is the total flouting of any kind of democratic process by the current administration compared to what happened in 1960. And of course, I think the other aspect of it is we were fighting at the time against the racism of the university toward Harlem and against the Vietnam War. These students are testing a genocide that is occurring before the eyes of the entire world that is being funded by U.S. arms. And if anyone has the right to rebel and to stand up against injustice, these students do. And I personally only wish that more students would follow their examples across the country, continue to disrupt disrupt the process that is occurring right now to at least allow the people of Palestine to understand that the American people are not united behind this genocide.
And Juan, do you have messages for the college presidents from your experience 56 years ago with the mass arrests of 700 students, which only provoked protests?
Well, I have to say that President Shafiq, who was, I understand, is a baroness. She was knighted in her time in England. Baroness has very little time left as president of Columbia University. I don't see how she survives in office, given the enormous resistance to her of not only the students, but the faculty. And I think that the universities across America have to realize that the young people of this country do not support the constant wars that are imperial wars that our government is either participating in or funding, and that something has to change.
Well, this is a discussion that will continue as we move into graduation season. But next up, we're speaking to the pioneering union organizer Jane McAlevey on the fight for labor rights and her own personal fight against against terminal cancer. We'll be back with her in 20 seconds.
Step by step, the longest march can be won. Can be won. Many stones to form an arch. Singly none, singly none. And by union, what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill. Singly none, singly none. Step by step, the longest march can be won.
Step by step, Sweet Honey in the Rock. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, to the hour with Jane McAlevey, the great labor organizer, scholar, and writer whose influence was felt when Volkswagen employees at the Chattanooga, Tennessee factory overwhelmingly voted last week to join the United Auto Workers Union. The plant will become the first foreign-owned car factory in the South to unionize. The decisive victory comes in the wake of the historic strike and contract gains with the U.S. auto industry's Big Three companies last year. The UAW has pledged to unionize auto workers across the country. On Sunday, UAW President Sean Fain spoke at a conference organized by Labor Notes.
4,000 workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, did what many people said was impossible. You know, we did what the pundits said couldn't be done. Every time I was interviewed by people and we talked about organizing the South, they would always do an eye roll and say, do you really think you can win in the South? And you know what? Those workers stood up for themselves. That's how we won, and they voted for a union.
The UAW is now bracing for its next fight, a union vote in Vance, Alabama, at one of Mercedes' two non-union U.S. plants, the company's only non-union plants worldwide. This comes as Supreme Court justices are hearing oral arguments in a case filed by Starbucks against the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, which could make it harder to address corporate interference and union drives. For more, we turn to Jane McAlevey. She's been an organizer in the labor movement for more than 20 years, the author of four books, including Rules to Win By and Power and Participation in Union Negotiation with Abby Lawler. She's also the author of A Collective Bargain, Unions Organizing and the Fight for Democracy, as well as other books. It's great to have you with us, Jane. We're going to talk about your remarkable you as a role model and strategist in the union movement, and also taking on your own struggle right now. But I want to start with Chattanooga and the significance of the UAW victory.
Yeah, because it's such a great story. I mean, you had 4,300 auto workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, on their third try. Honestly, they should have had a union there 10 years ago, 6 years ago. But this win wasn't just a win. It was what we would call a beatdown. They beat the employer 72%. The numbers are astounding. So part of what was so great about it is they, in Chattanooga, a lot of what I have been talking and writing and practicing about for decades, which is they had a supermajority strategy. They said they wouldn't file for election until they had a what we call a supermajority of the engaged on public petitions saying we're ready to vote yes. And when you lead with a public petition that says, we're going to vote yes, you are signaling to the employer, we're coming to get you. And that's exactly what they did. They were having parties. They were having T-shirt parties. They were walking around in red T-shirts in that plant for weeks leading up to the election. They were messaging all the things that those of us who win really hard campaigns, and I don't know any campaign anymore that isn't hard. It's all the stuff that we do. Those of us winning in the last 4 years, while too many national labor leaders sat around debating, we can't really win. We have to change labor law. We have to do all these things, when all we have to do is actually start trusting that workers are really intelligent, that if we teach them what it takes to win, which is building super majority organization before the election, that's going to carry them into a great first contract fight. And that's just what they did in Chattanooga. And I hope they're going to march right into Alabama and do the same, because that's going to really rock the House of the South of this country, if we walk this in Mercedes plant on May 17th.
And yes, and I wanted to ask you about that, Jane, the Alabama struggle, and also this whole issue of unionizing these foreign car companies that have moved increasingly established plants here in the United States, and especially in the South.
You, Amy, as well. Yeah, I mean, this was, look, Volkswagen didn't have a single auto plant in the world that didn't have a union. So the idea that, like, the United States South is such a right-wing bastion of anti-trade unionism that the one place in the world where workers didn't have a union was the United States South tells you a lot about how broken U.S. labor law is. The Economic Policy Institute, EPI, said recently from some recent polling, 60 million American workers would have a union tomorrow if they were allowed to vote free and fair. And what we're seeing at Mercedes is different than Chattanooga. In Chattanooga, there was an agreement with IG Metall, with the German union. It helped totally mitigate what the employer was doing in Chattanooga, but it helped calm down the kind of vicious tactical warfare that we're starting to see already in the Mercedes. They have posts up that say things like, the UAW endorsed Joe Biden. Is that a Southern union? So they're starting to run. They have fired several people just in the last plant. So I think once the Chattanooga numbers came in and Mercedes looked at Volkswagen and said, well, this was a beatdown. This was a total extraordinary victory in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The momentum is changing. They decided that they were going to go all out to start trying to bust the union. So now until May 17th, when that vote count happens, every one of us needs to be asking the UAW for anything that they can do to support those workers. But it's a Alabama-driven campaign. And one thing I want to say about this that's really important before I pause is just the worker committee in the Mercedes plant is an incredible worker-led movement with staff support for sure, right? You need professional staff in this country, given the union busting laws, to help give you advice. But that movement in the Mercedes plant in particular is a seriously worker-driven campaign, and I can't wait first to vote yes. It'll be a massive change in the U.S. South.
And I wanted to ask you about the role of Sean Fain here. He spoke at a Labor Notes conference. For people who are not familiar with Labor Notes, this is the organization that has been backing rank-and-file movements for decades. And to have a UAW president speak at a Labor Notes conference in itself is highly unusual. I'm wondering your sense of the impact of the democracy movement that occurred within the UAW and its effect on the labor movement.
Yeah. I mean, this is a source of personal joy because I'm a UAW member for many years, including that I was part of the 48,000 worker strike. So I had the pleasure of voting in the ballot to get direct democracy in the United Auto Workers. And then I had the pleasure of pulling the lever for Sean Fain, doing some fundraisers on the West Coast with a bunch of folks for him. So to watch him go from winning the election, contested, highly contested, basically taking over in early March, walking into what was their negotiations every 4 years, their National Negotiations Conference in late March, going into and leading a series of unprecedented strikes that resulted in victories, had a direct impact on the workers in Chattanooga deciding, hey, we want some of that, right? Like, we want to top out at $40 an hour instead of the least that we top out at right now in Chattanooga, Tennessee. So Sean Fain is already becoming the kind of trade union leader that we need many, many more of. And I am thrilled that he is my union president. And I'm thrilled that I got to participate in the direct democracy movement that helped put Sean Fain in, because we are seeing what one risk-taking, strategic, smart trade union leader can do in literally less than a year. He's created a movement in less than 12 months.
Jane McAlevey, your incredibly strong voice doesn't convey it, but in addition to fighting for labor rights, you are battling terminal cancer in the fall of 2021, diagnosed with multiple myeloma. You recently wrote a piece titled, I Have Stopped All Work to Turn to Home-Based Hospice for the Remainder of My Time. Can you talk about this struggle?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a struggle that's basically coming to an end. I received what's called a high-risk form of multiple myeloma. Very dangerous. It's called the 414 mutation. And from day one, they said you had a handful of years to live. And I just didn't look back. I just woke up the next day and kept organizing. Because to me, while I was absolutely paying attention to my doctors, going through chemo, going through radiation, we got to the point where we had quickly run the clock on everything available to treat me, and I was moving into clinical trials. I was doing clinical trial drugs, and at this point, my cancer is ahead of the clinical trial drugs, and there is nothing left. So several weeks ago, I was hospitalized for a few weeks, kind of delirious out of it, which happens a lot in the last 3 years. I would quietly just be hospitalized and not know what was going on around me. They thought I would be dead a few weeks ago. I'm out again. I'm riding my bike. I'm on your show. And I'm going to fight until the last dying minute, because that's what American workers deserve.
Well, you're truly amazing. And this isn't the end of our conversation. It is the end of the show. But we'd like to do a part two with you and talk more about labor. Going back to your student years, taking on the anti-apartheid movement and what that meant as students have these encampments around
really
the country.
I'm familiar being a student activist.
And you have a lot to teach people. I want to thank you so much for being with us and for all that you've offered, not just the labor movement, but you're in organizing, your brilliance and strategizing. Thank you so much. We're going to do part two in a minute. Jane McAlevey, labor organizer for 20 years. That does it for our show. To see that interview, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPIRG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of-action groups at SFPIRG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.
This is Raccoon City, and I'm your host, Katie. So happy you're here. Now it's time to sit back, relax, and enjoy some awesome music. Hello, and welcome back. Whoa. This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Community Radio Station, Simon Fraser. We broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the Coquitlam, Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh. You can listen online at cj.ca or on our new radio app, which you can download from the app or Google Store, depending on your device. Wow! Welcome! This is Raccoon City every Tuesday, 12 to 1. I'm your host, Katie, for this next wonderful, amazing, awesome, cool hour. I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy that you're here. I'm so happy that this existence is